The parallel economy has empowered us to care for our health, well-being, as well as longevity. Likewise, for us pet parents who now have a place to go when it comes to keeping the family dogs, cats, even horses in the best shape possible. As a dog dad, I'm thrilled to be working with Pet Club 24/7, a company founded by two guys who lost dogs to serious conditions, including cancer. Pet Club 24/7 has an incredible array of products, including a line of supplements for humans, such as the Inforce Plus Corollius Versicolor and Inforce Corollius Versicolor with Reishi. My friend and colleague, Christina Ferrari, a cancer survivor herself, swears by it.
When I was diagnosed, the doctor in the emergency room told me, "You have 2 years to live."
Oh boy.
Along with the stem cell, I took these. I have been in remission for 8 years now.
For dogs, mush puppy treats are a fan favorite. Rex, you want to? Oh boy. He came right. Oh, there he is. They are also made with the Coriolis versicolor mushroom, which supports their immune system, according to hundreds of clinical studies. Here's Kristen Ludlow, National Vice President.
That strain does matter. We do have the most potent strain, and we also extract it in a proprietary way. And that's why we've been having such wonderful experiences with these products.
Mush puppies are made here in the U.S. There are no fillers. It's non-addicting. Your dog can't accidentally overdose. Go to drdrew.com/petclub247 for a discount off the list price. That is drdrew.com. PETCLUB247, Pet Club 247.
All conversations and information exchanged during participation in this podcast or interaction on the DrDrew.com website is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or physician medical advice or direction per se. You must always follow your medical professional's advice and direction. Nothing on these podcasts or posted on this site supplements or supersedes the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Please understand, I am not playing the role of physician in this environment per se. I'm educating. I am a licensed physician with specialty boards in American Board of Internal Medicine and American Board of Addiction Medicine.
Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Gentlemen, boys and girls, here we are again for another episode of This Life with Dr. Drew and Bob. And Dr. Drew's wearing a Don't Die Wisconsin shirt.
I am indeed. I forgot representing.
Representing. They'll be excited.
So you're good?
I'm good.
You want to talk about media or something?
Yeah, I want to talk about it. There's just too much of it.
can I bring our guest in first?
Yeah.
Zach Gowan, he lost his leg to cancer at age 8. He went on to become the first one-legged professional wrestler in history. At 19, he signed a 3-year contract with WWE. And you can see him on SmackDown and American Ninja Warrior. Welcome, Zach. Zach, how are you?
There he is.
I'm doing well, Dr. Drew. Bob, how are you guys? Thank you for having me on. This is really exciting.
It's cool. Thanks for being on.
You guys are freaking legends. I'm so happy to be here talking with you guys.
Where are you now?
I'm in my home in Detroit, Michigan.
Detroit.
Yes, sir.
Is that where you grew up?
This is where I grew up, born and raised.
Nice. And Zach has a substance history.
Yes,
he does.
I know that. Due to the leg amputation.
Yeah, did it start with opiate exposure during the cancer treatment?
Yes, but I don't really remember that too much. I remember the first time I got drunk and high. It was very vivid. I was 16 years old, and I felt very close to a spiritual experience. You know,
I really
believe that if normal people experience drugs and alcohol the way that addicts experience drugs and alcohol, there wouldn't be any confusion as to why we do what we do. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
we feel
right.
It at a depth and gravity that most people don't understand. But when I was 8 years old going through cancer, I really don't remember the drugs. I just remember being in a lot of pain and not feeling good.
Well, Zach, there's sort of two versions of what you described there at 16. One version is relief, like I've been carrying pain around, and this is the first time. This is how normal people feel. You know, I'm feeling okay for the first time in my life. Versus, oh my God, this is the greatest thing ever. Now, the oh my God part with alcohol, particularly. Occurs in certain ethnic groups. Do you have any North American Indian background?
Zach, did we lose him?
I'm sorry, you're breaking up a little bit.
Oh, okay. Do you have any Native American in you?
Not that I know of, no.
So Irish. Irish.
I'm Irish. Yeah. I'm an Irish boy.
That's the other group. So it's
Irish
Scottish,
is the next best thing.
Yeah, Irish, Scottish, North American, Indian. Those are the ones that have the experience with alcohol that's, oh, my God, this is the greatest thing ever.
I had an oh, my God.
Yeah.
It felt like a new dimension opened up, and I was experiencing something for the first time in my life, and it was such a euphoria. And for me, once I started, the compulsion aspect didn't kick in for a number of years after.
No, but the looking forward.
But I do vividly remember the first time that euphoria. I grabbed my buddy by his shoulders. I looked deep into his eyes, and I said, "Brother, are you feeling what I'm feeling right now? Because this is amazing."
Right, and the idea is that you don't. I had the same experience at like 15 or 16, and you don't jump into daily use. What I made a mental note of.
Right.
Anytime I can be this free, I am going to be this free.
Yeah.
So that meant not during the school week. So that meant Friday night. You know, you still had this balance in your life of wanting to achieve your goals, and slowly and insidiously, that gets eroded.
Gets taken away.
Yeah, it gets by the. I drank in my sophomore year of high school. By my senior year, I was drinking in classrooms. Right, but initially, like what you're describing, Zach, I didn't do it the next night. But
right.
Now I had the thing that I was gonna do when I could and have fun.
Strangely,
with.
Though, people do get that sort of digital experience with pot, where it's like, oh my God, I got to do this again. They wake up worrying, thinking about it the next day.
I think
day.
Nowadays they do, but in my day, pot was, you could smell it. It was super illegal.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
super criminalized. But alcohol, you know, was something you were going to do for an evening,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I remember having a similar experience. I always tell this story. I drank a six-pack of beer split between two of my friends and me. I drank the third one because the one guy said it was making him feel sick. I was like, okay. And I looked at the other guy, like, which one of us is going to have that one? And he wasn't looking like he was enjoying it too much either.
Oh, my God, that's so
funny. So that experience, that's the beginning. And then it works a long time, doesn't it, Zach, for fun and frivolity?
Oh, yeah. Well, if it didn't work, I wouldn't have done it. Like it worked really well. It worked almost too well.
That's another thing that normal.
And to piggyback off your point, Bob, I think normal people experience drugs and alcohol. They'll have two or three drinks, and then they experience that slightly out of control, tipsy feeling. I have two or three drinks, and I feel more in control,
right,
so to speak. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's just the way that it reacts and metabolizes in my body. And I can't really, you know, pinpoint a genetic component to it or a reason behind it. I just know that that's what the evidence suggests.
Well, and a guy named Mark Schuckett did a cohort of sons of alcoholic fathers and tried to predict what feature predicted the probability of developing alcoholism, and resistance to alcohol intoxication.
Yeah, tolerance
was the single biggest predictor. Not tolerance. You just don't get intoxicated. You get what, Zach? You get focused. It's why alcoholics don't get hit for DUIs until their blood levels are way up.
Right.
So.
Well, yeah, I got energy from alcohol. I got energy from opiates.
Top Jimmy, the guy that taught me a lot, his name's Top Jimmy. He's in the documentary about me, the claymation guy, right? So he was really drunk, and he asked to use my car one night when I was about 21, right? And I said, "Jimmy, you're too drunk to drive." He goes, "Oh, no, Mr. Jones. This is the best time for me to drive.
Wow.
Tomorrow morning, it's a bad time for me to drive." Tomorrow morning, it's a bad time
That's
for
it.
Me to drive.
Yeah. The only reason I got a DUI is because I made an illegal U-turn. And a cop saw me make an illegal U-turn, and I had a headlight that was out. I think I blew like a 0.20, which blew him away because I was driving just fine and I was having a conversation just like you and I are having this conversation. But that really speaks to the tolerance that developed up at a certain point. You
and
know,
they're lowering the blood alcohol level here in California 0.5, right?
Which is like 0.05. A half a glass of wine.
Right. Wow!
So that's just to make more money for the state.
Probably.
Is my take on it.
So what was your bottom, Zach? What happened?
I don't know. I think I had, I didn't plan on getting sober.
Ah.
I didn't really want to get sober. I reached a point in my life where I thought there was only two options. I thought, okay, well, I can drink and I can use drugs and I can be miserable. Because at this point, everything just kind of stopped working. And the other option for me was to not drink and not use drugs and be miserable. I really thought that those are my only two options that I was looking at. And I felt there was an end near. And that end, whether it was death or getting sober, I was open to either one, whichever came first. And I thank God that recovery came first. I remember I was living with my mom, and she cornered me in the kitchen one day, and she just asked me, she goes, "Zach, what's wrong with you? Are you on drugs? Are you high? What is happening?" I mean, I thought I was really good at hiding it, but obviously she knew, because she went through this with my father, and she knew that something was wrong with me at this point. And for some reason, the truth came out, and I wanted to lie. I wanted to say, no, I'm fine. Everything's good. So I can continue the life that I was living in terms of using drugs and drinking. But this weird out of body third person looking down on my head experience happened, and the words came out of my mouth, and those words were, yes, I'm high, but I don't want to be, and I'm scared, and I don't know what to do, and I need help. And for some reason, these words just spilled out of my mouth, and that set off the chain, a reaction. For the past, 9 years, I've been living this life of complete sobriety, and I'm living a life that I didn't even know was possible.
So when you were really in the middle of your high-flying disease, were you wrestling? Professional wrestling?
Yes, I was trying to. I experienced the
most. But that world is full of drugs, right? That world is full of drugs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I'm still wrestling now. And it's funny to go to these shows and to be offered drugs and drinks all the time. and I always say no.
I don't think Drew knows.
And then people get weird when I say no. They're like, oh, my God, I'm sorry. I didn't know. I didn't. And I say, no, I appreciate the offer, and I appreciate the spirit behind what you're trying to do, but that's not something I partake in.
But let's go into wrestling, because Drew thinks it's just the prescription opiates. Everybody, it's like rock and roll. I've been around it a little bit. It's like cocaine and Xanax. Isn't the wrestling world like that?
It's like rock and roll. It's just like any other performance or any other entertainment industry. We're up late at night performing these shows. We got to get up early in the morning and go on to the next town, and we have to maintain. Plus, we're beating our bodies up completely. Plus, you get the adrenaline and the rush for performing, and you get the adulation and people cheering for you and all of that. And it's all mixed. Of course, it's good. It's a perfect petri dish for drugs and alcohol. I mean, how could it go any other way?
Right. There's a great documentary about Andre the Giant. I mean, that guy knew how to party, right? Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, there's stories of him drinking 100 beers in
100
one setting.
100 beers, Andre the Giant.
He had a move where if somebody pissed him off, he'd come evacuate himself on their bed.
What?
Yes. I forget who told me that story.
What does evacuate self mean?
I forget who told me that story about
him. He shit on their bed?
Yes.
So that's why, I was a little bit on the fringes of the wrestling world in the early 90s, right? I knew a couple wrestlers, and it was really what I always thought rock and roll was like. They do cocaine right before they go out there.
But they're doing steroids too. So steroids are stimulant already.
And what about cocaine?
And
with
just
it?
puts a little icing on top.
It goes together. There was an old, remember all the different routes, Zach? There was a southern route, a southern district that McMahon had. A friend of mine was Golden Boy Mike Golden, his name was. That was his wrestling name. Have you ever heard of this guy? Golden Boy Mike Golden.
Look him up.
Right. I've never heard of Mike Golden, so he was before the 80s, before Vince McMahon and WWE monopolized the industry and made it a global brand, there was territories in the South.
Yeah, he was in
Los Angeles, Oregon, Mid-South, East Coast. You know what I'm saying? So the business itself was broken up into separate territories.
Yeah, and he was a part of that Southern territory. And Thelonious Monster toured a lot, and we would always be in the same town, and we'd go to the wrestling matches, and it was so exciting. and it was a perfect place for a guy like me. So now you're sober and you're in that world? I bet you there's more sober people in it now.
There's been an absolute shift in the culture, because like you're talking about, all of these, a lot of these stars from the 80s and early 90s they were dropping off like flies.
Dying?
And it was an industry-wide epidemic. So there was a huge cultural shift, I want to say about 10, 12 years ago, when WWE implemented a policy, a wellness policy, stating that anybody under contract or anybody who's ever been under contract with the company, the company will pay for their treatment.
Wow.
If they're struggling with
substance.
Yeah, and because of this policy, I'm convinced this policy saved my life and a number of my contemporaries' lives that are walking the path now with me. And I'm very, very, very grateful.
See, there's something that somebody can make a decision at a management level and make a profound effect on their industry.
I've always said that in athletic endeavors, the NBA is the model for it. You can have an inclusive system pretty easily if you just have the right set of policies and procedures.
Well, but pay for treatment too is the key,
yeah.
Right?
But they could manage that payment. They could have outpatient, inpatient. They could all kinds of ways of doing it.
Right. And so Drew just Googled and found a picture of Golden Boy Mike Golden, and he looks like a guy in Motley Crue, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
It's so crazy. Yeah. The 80s were so great. There was no
difference. I missed out.
There's no difference.
I was a kid. I missed out on it.
There was no difference between the wrestlers and the rock and rollers and the basketball players. They were all on drugs.
Good times.
Good times.
You can follow Zach at Zach Gowan, GOWAN.com, Instagram, Twitter, @ Zach Gowan. And Zach, what are you doing these days? I understand you're doing some stuff for youth engagement, working with kids.
Yeah, it's the best. And it's ZACHGOWEN.
Oh,
not AN.
Oh, thank you.
Not to correct the great Dr. Drew.
No, my producer.
Like that, but I want to make sure.
My producer misspelled it.
Wait,
thank
say
you.
That again?
It's G-O-W-E-N.
And if I had looked up at the screen, I would have seen that.
And is it right. Z-A-C-H?
Yes.
Okay. Z-A-C-H, yep, G-O-W-E-N.
Okay, we'll make sure we get that right. And what's
your name? Thank you. And so my main source of income is I travel the country with the nation's leading youth engagement company called CoolSpeak. We go to inner city, we go into suburban, we go rural, we go everywhere, and we work with kids. And what I'm really doing is sharing the tools that I've learned in recovery, and I'm putting it in a language that these kids can digest and understand. And of course, I'm using the hook of, you know, having a robotic leg and wrestling John Cena and competing on American Ninja Warrior. I'm using all of that as a bridge to be able to connect with these kids and hopefully plant a seed of inspiration and hope, because you know, the biggest problem I see is disconnectedness and these kids who are disenfranchised and they're lost. And I was once one of those kids in the audience. So to be able to share through my experience, hopefully plant some seeds of inspiration, give them some tools. For me, it's kind of a full circle deal, and it's very, very satisfying. It's certainly, to me, more satisfying than professional wrestling. But I also still wrestle part-time, because that scratches an itch that speaking and keynoting and workshopping with CoolSpeak doesn't quite get. And I also teach yoga too.
Wow.
I also teach DDP yoga. And I run classes all over Detroit, and I work with amputees, and I work with kids, and I work with Children's Hospital. And basically my life is built upon service and sharing my story in hopes of helping others. And it really makes life worth living.
Detroit's becoming more of a community again, right? People are moving there. People are, I know some people live in Detroit, and they say something's changing in Detroit. Is that true? You can feel it?
100%. Yeah, there's a big cultural shift after 50, 60 years of political corruption, and the city, you know, basically
falling apart
at the seams. There's been a resurgence, and it's starting in downtown Detroit, and it's starting to spread out to the city limits. And it's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen in 2 or 3 years. This is going to be a generational type of situation. But we're definitely, you know, we're tough people. People from Detroit are tough, man. We're resilient and we're gritty, and we like to roll up our sleeves and get to work. That's what the city was founded upon.
Can you talk a little bit about because friends of mine, my older son too, the city is now giving the kind of abandoned homes to people if they're guaranteed to fix them up and get them operational, or they'll sell them to you for like $1,000 or something.
Sure.
Have you heard about this, Drew? It's so exciting. It makes me want to move to Detroit.
Like it's a great place to move to, and it's a great place to invest in now. And there's so many of these abandoned houses because the actual area square mileage of the city is so vast and so large that it's almost too big. And so you have a lot of these houses, and you have a lot of these programs coming in, and people investing into the city, and you see people all around taking advantage of these programs. And for me, it's just going to be it's a sight to see.
And
hopefully,
cool,
my children,
houses,
you know, will once will be able to see Detroit in all of its glory when they get older.
I have a feeling it's coming back, and that you're getting some industry to come back there. But one of the things that it was about 10 years ago, a friend of mine bought a house there that was three stories with an elevator.
Jesus.
For like $250,000, right?
Yep.
It was falling apart,
yeah.
Right? And all, but there's all these incentives for people to move back to Detroit and take care of your community coffee shop,
yeah,
and start a record store and
yes,
re-energize the communities. And it's exciting that it's happening all across America, but Detroit was way ahead of the curve.
Yep, you're getting a lot of that now. It really is exciting.
Yeah.
So, Bob, this is Zach, I think, is a good person maybe to bring this topic of that we were discussing, because he's dealing with youth and disenfranchised youth and disconnected youth. The media. You want to talk a little about the media. We never got to it.
Yeah, I just think there's so much – there's some pet peeves I have about media, and I don't know where the rules come from. So this thing with Lady Gaga, right? And she was singing a song at the Grammys with the guy Bradley Cooper. I don't know if you saw it.
At the Academy Awards.
Yeah, and a bunch of – Academy Awards. A bunch of people making it like they're having an affair. They're actors. They're musicians.
Listen, when Dolly
Parton and Kenny Rogers sang Islands in the Stream, nobody said they're fucking.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. The Twitter media is ridiculous.
Well, that goes without saying. But we respond to it and we, you know.
But mainstream media quotes Twitter.
Oh, of course.
And I wonder, you know, you come from a world that's kind of known, Zach, for manipulating the truth and distorting reality, and is wrestling real and all that stuff that went on in the 80s and 90s, right? What do you
– Exactly.
Don't you think the whole world has just become wrestling?
Yeah. That's exactly what I think.
Exactly right.
That's the glasses in which I view our political landscape. Our media,
social
media, everybody is becoming a character, and they're either a good guy or they're a bad guy or they're something to elicit an emotional response in their audience to get them to keep coming back. That's all this is, and that's all I see.
So I've been quoting lately, I remember when I was I was probably a teenager, I was watching a 60-minute thing. It was in the 70s. And this 60-minute sort of investigative reporter was talking to a Soviet journalist in Russia. And she was busting his balls and, you know, the manipulation of the Soviet press. And finally he looks at her and he goes, look, in our country, in the Soviet Union, the media, the news media, is a political enterprise. In your country, it's a commercial enterprise. You will manipulate things just as much for commercial ends as we will for political ends. Why are you judging us? And now we're in a zone where the commercial goal of capturing eyes is so out of control that it's, I would argue, more distorted than a Soviet political enterprise. At least then they had some, I wouldn't say obligation, but need to be truthful so they weren't found to be lying, you know what
right.
I mean? To be overtly manipulating. Here, doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Whatever narrative they can cram up the ass
and
of
that's
the American
what
people, they will do it.
And the reason why I bring it up, Zach, is because I've been talking about this Detroit and Baltimore. Those are the two towns. I had to learn it from my 24-year-old son that these programs are in Detroit, that you can buy a home for $1,000. The
metropolitization of America is actually happening and it's working, but yet media doesn't cover it.
Media doesn't cover anything positive. Anything doesn't fit their narrative. They have narratives.
Exciting that Detroit is coming back, and he's proud to be from Detroit.
If somebody in a MAGA hat beat up a black boy, that's the narrative. That's the narrative. We're gonna go with that. Go immediately. It's a modern lynching. Modern lynching. Immediately. But begs no. And when that Jussie Smollett thing broke, I went, what? 2 a.m, -5 degrees. 2 guys waiting for him. And just so with the bleach and the hats what? I at least just went. It's too horrible to really question severely, but it just wasn't making sense to me.
But get back to Zach. Zach, doesn't that thing that happened with that kid in Chicago? Doesn't it seem like something that McMahon would come up with?
You can totally see that on Monday Night Raw and them spinning that into an angle on the road to WrestleMania.
But the news.
Yeah, they might even have the kid at WrestleMania.
Might
be a thing they might want to do.
That's funny.
The whole world is becoming wrestling.
But here's the thing that bothers me. If the media would just go, like the news media would just go, either one of two things. Like, well, you know. We got caught with our pants down. We should check our sources better, or maybe we should not run with the narrative, you know, initially. But you know, that's the way we are. We go with this stuff. Or they need to put together like a Manhattan Project where they look at themselves and like try to change their culture, because there's something horribly wrong. If this were medicine or law, oh my God, there would be like meetings about this. But the journalists just go, hey, stop calling us fake news. Stop it. All Don't right. you dare. We work hard at it. Like, no, well, get your shit together. Stop reporting fake news, and then we'll stop saying fake news.
It's not even news that's being reported. And that's where I just like it's more like what Zach says. It's just the characters that they've made up and the attention that they get.
The narratives.
And then,
the narratives.
But there's something going on good here in L.A. It's a thing called Spectrum News. Have you ever heard of it, Zach?
No.
It's a new thing. It's all local news, all local stories about, like, the housing projects and the positive things happen in the community, the opportunities happen in the community. I was on it last Thursday. It was amazing.
Well, New York One's always been that, right?
Yeah, and so that modeling
thing.
Spectrum.
Do you
have Spectrum here?
Yeah, they've asked me to come. I'm trying to get to them on Friday.
Yeah, you got
to
go on. It's really great because it's stories that you really care about, like Zach working with the kids and trying to inspire.
Yep.
Important things that are going on instead of all of this wrestling. Not that I don't like wrestling, Zach. but the whole
world. Well, no, there's got to be a market for that. I mean, it's almost like a cottage industry or a result of you're either on this side or you're that side that the media has really exploited.
Well,
what I'm saying?
No, but
there's got to be a market for it.
I think let's think about this a little more deeply, because I think just like wrestling's sort of like cotton candy. You know what I mean? We'll all kind of direct our vision that way. We kind of like it knows how to capture our eyes.
When
it knows how to get our attention. But we're also going on the intellectual dark web. We're listening to podcasts. It's created all that to get us away from the cotton candy, and we're looking for steak, or if you're vegan, something like that.
Yeah, something a little different in appetite. But you know, I got to admit, like, when I'm turning the channel, especially when Raw is on, and you click on it at the right moment when you're channel surfing, and there's a bad guy, like the sergeant guy. I remember the sergeant guy. I like, you know, because I'm not a big sergeant.
Sergeant Slaughter.
Sergeant Slaughter.
The Iron Sheik.
I loved that guy. I loved hating that guy. You know what I mean? He's an exaggerated version of what I unhealthily don't like about authority. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And so it's this, it is
so
this,
you can't not look. You
yeah,
can't
you
look
can't
away.
Not look.
Right.
Because I know it's a joke and I know he's exaggerating the stereotype of a sergeant, an army drill sergeant. I hate those army drill sergeant authoritative types. I watch. That's good for wrestling or sports or entertainment. It shouldn't be for news and media and politics.
Right. So your point is exactly
So my
on.
Point is Republicans, and the CPAC meeting was over the weekend. Just a picture of Elizabeth Warren can set them off into drama. You know what I mean? As Trump does for liberals.
Yes,
right?
Which is weird.
And we got to get away from that. We got to learn what it is and get away from it and get back to things like helping our disenfranchised communities, helping revitalize our great cities like Detroit,
but Bob,
doing something positive.
But listen, you've tapped on something really, really important when you brought up the spectrum thing. In the context of this bigger national problem of the, what do we call the news media, the wrestling match that is news media, is that it forces us all to look locally. Because the national thing is like, oy, ugh. But we do start
to
look.
Well, people are already asking me who I'm going to vote for president. It's not even for 2 years.
It forces
I don't
you
know.
To look locally.
What does that matter? Do we have to wait 2 years till something important
we're
happens?
We're overwhelmed by the national thing, so we start to look locally to our cities and our counties and where we can really get something done.
Yeah.
And I think that's.
This is where I live. I don't live in Washington, D.C.
Right. What does Washington do for you? Name one thing.
It did curb the opiate epidemic. I can tell you that's one good thing that they did.
I agree with you.
Right? Yeah. A little too much, I would say.
I would agree with you.
A little bit. Wouldn't you agree, Zach? A little bit of opiates is pretty good.
Yeah, a little bit goes a long way when it comes to the opiates.
Now it's literally verboten anywhere in America to get a...
Yeah, I told you I was there when I saw... When I was in the White House when they announced that policy.
Like you get people
like, oh,
with
boy.
Broken legs at the emergency room being given seven... Given seven like low grade opiates, like that's a little ridiculous.
It's a little ridiculous, but it we needed to turn the battleship around, so you had to hit hard and furious. And okay, it's done it.
And so now with the
they
kids,
won't get the credit for it though. There'll be no credit.
No credit. So with the kids, have you been working with them long enough to have adults that you worked with that you mentored and that their lives have turned around? Because that's the most rewarding thing.
The best thing for me is these 5 and 6 year grants that we get to implement and work with these kids. So we'll meet these kids when they're 13 years old in eighth grade, and they are bad kids. There's no other way to describe. But we get to work with them every single year. So we see, not only do we inspire them and give them these tools and then give them the motivation to bend down and pick them up and get to work, we get to see their progress from when they're 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade. We establish a connection. And then when you see one of these kids who come from, you know, foster or they're in a severely broken home, terrible environment, and you see these kids, you know, graduate high school and go on to college, there really isn't a feeling that I can describe that feeling,
right?
You know, because it feels like you're making a difference. You know,
we have to take
you're seeing these kids who by all accounts and every single person would look at these kids as hopeless. Their situation is dire. You know, they go to these schools that look more like prisons than they do schools or places of learning. And their home life is even worse than their school life. And you see them, the light turn on and the possibilities open in their minds. And it's like, well, maybe there's another life out there outside of what's in my neighborhood right now.
Right.
And to see them walk that path
and
to graduate high school and to go on to great things is really amazing.
And that it's possible that they could have that life. You need people around kids that come from disenfranchised backgrounds to keep reminding them, dude, yes, you can have that life. You know, because no one else in that family
or that system. I'm sorry, Bob. I didn't mean to step on your toes. Yeah. I get fired up talking about this, though, because they don't realize. It's not about, hey, you got to follow your dreams. I mean, that's what everybody hammers down these kids' throat, follow your dreams. The fact is, a lot of these kids don't have dreams to begin with.
Right.
So if they don't have dreams or an idea of what could possibly happen beyond their environment, beyond what they can see and touch and feel, then how can they follow their dreams if they don't know what they are in the first place?
Right. That's it. And that's what I think, you know, you know, you're in the 12-step world probably. In the 12-step world, I always figure you're helping an adult become an adult. It's not that big of a deal.
Well,
but
to
help a child who's 8 or 10 or 12 who's headed towards prison and a life of multi-generational poverty, they're just a link in the chain of that, and help inspire them to get off that track into mainstream life is one of the most amazing things.
So let me just quote some data that when people study kids that come from traumatic backgrounds, they find that the outcomes of these children are typically not, they can't explain the ones that do well. And because there's some
mentor, somebody taking an interest.
That's exactly right. It turns out that a single sustained quality relationship with an adult outside the home, typically somewhere around age 8 to 10, that's sustained throughout adolescence, turns the course entirely.
Right.
It can turn the that entirely.
I was one of those kids. I come from an alcoholic, broken, and abusive home. When I was 4 years old, my father decided that his relationship with drugs and alcohol was going to be more important than his relationship with me or my mom. We grew up in government housing. We had 4 bullet holes in the side of my mom's station wagon, on the way to before we woke up to go to preschool that day. That's the environment that I come from. And then at 8 years old, of course, the traumatic event of cancer, losing my leg, and seeing my mom struggle, doing everything that she can on her own to provide for me while her kid's dying in front of her, and to go, I can't even imagine. I have a 6 and a 2 year old right now, and they're the most perfect, beautiful little boys you'd ever meet in your life. And the fact is, through the application of spiritual principles, I can be the father I never had to these kids. They've never seen me high. They've never seen me drunk. They've never seen me hit their mother. They don't have to grow up in the environment that I grew up in. They can grow up in a stable and loving environment. And in addition to, and all of my work perpetuates that, and I can do that for other kids too that walk similar paths as I did, man. And that's what makes life worth living for me.
Who was it that was there for you at 8 through that cancer or post that cancer once you had your leg
amputated? Or maybe it was just recovery that got him.
Was it a wrestling coach? Was it some? It's usually in my day it was sports coaches. Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't have. You talked about not liking authority. I didn't have any relationship with anybody in authority, especially a male role model until I got sober.
Okay,
that was the first time I ever had a positive male role model in my life.
So who was it that got you through into life? Your mom?
Well, that was my love of professional wrestling because when my leg was amputated 2 weeks after, they let me go home for the first time. My grandma ordered the 1992 Royal Rumble for me, which Ric Flair won the WWE Heavyweight Championship for the first time. And for the 3 hours that event played in front of my eyes, I didn't feel the pain of not having my leg. I didn't feel the pain of having cancer. I didn't feel the pain of not really fitting in or not having my dad around. All of that went away when I tapped into the magic of professional wrestling.
And he probably had a bunch of other, lots of relationship stuff there, but really sobriety is what got him out. Did you have a Ewing sarcoma? Is that what happened?
I had osteosarcoma.
Yeah. That's sort of typical kid leg tumor. It's awful. Jeez. Well, Zach, listen, thank you for the work you're doing, and thank you for spending some time with us here. We really appreciate it.
Detroit!
Yeah.
Hey, my pleasure, guys. Like I said, you guys are absolute legends. I love you guys very much. Thank you for all you do, both of you, for people like me and for the people who love people like me. Your sphere of influence is so large, and I'm so happy that I was able to share some time, space, and experience with you guys.
Well, thanks for coming on.
Listen, man,
go down.
It.
Is St. Andrew's Hall still there with punk bands?
Yeah.
Hell yeah. St. Andrew's Hall.
I'm laughing. I've performed in St. Andrew's Hall probably 20-25 times.
Oh my God,
I love it's a historic building.
It really
so
is.
Follow Zach Gowen, G-O-W-E, and Instagram, E-N. Twitter at Zach Gowen, ZachGowen.com. Thanks, Zach. We'll talk soon, I hope.
Thank you, guys.
All right. So long. We'll take a little break. Be right back. Well, CBDs are everywhere, right? Everyone's talking about them, and it's a topic that I get asked about all the time. Bottom line on CBD, although there are way more claims made about them, the clinical evidence right now, it's not all that clear, but many people are using it and reporting great results, and they are very encouraging. So I want to first define exactly what I'm talking about here. CBD is cannabidiol, an extract from hemp. While you might associate with marijuana, CBD does not cause reinforcement. It is not the reinforcing component of hemp, but it is what's responsible for the calming or some of the relaxing effects that many people experience, not the high. Now about the products. There are a ton of them on the market today. Forgetting the vast array of the reported health benefits, it's important to be aware of what you're buying. I was recently introduced to a company called Select CBD, an Oregon-based company that focuses on high-quality ingredients and manufacturing standards, not the hype. Their CBD-based products are available in a wide range of formulations and flavors, each of which is described to you so you can make an informed decision without all those promises that are probably too good to be true. Like I said, the reported benefits of CBD by individuals using this are very compelling. I'm excited to see how things develop as the science catches up with this booming industry. As usual, the public is ahead of the science. I can't make explicit claims yet, but boy, the reports are pretty encouraging. So if you're ready to try CBD, I encourage you to check out Select CBD. To learn more, go to drdrew.com/select. That's on my site, drdrew.com/SELECT. And for a limited time, you can save 25% at checkout with the code Dr. Drew, DRDREW. Again, drdrew.com/select, and then the code DRDREW. And we are back, and we are, yes, we are offering a birthday celebration to our Nate the Man, our engineer. Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Nate.
Happy birthday to you. He came in on his birthday to help us record these podcasts.
Aww. He's the genius of all podcasts.
It's true.
How many podcasts is Nate a part of in a week? 20?
I'm sure.
Not that many.
I'm sure.
Happy Nathan year.
Five a day. Five a week.
There's two every day.
Two
and then
ten
whatever
every
with
day.
You.
Ten every
ten
week.
A week. Plus.
And then all just.
No.
So this is the great producer brought cupcakes for all.
So 10.
Those are crazy looking cupcakes.
They are beautiful.
20 a week, probably, you do a week.
So I know we've completely changed gears on this pod. We've said goodbye to Zach, and now we brought Simone Bien in, who just happened to stop by, and we asked her to sit down and
for
answer.
For the cakes.
For the cakes.
And for
Nate's
birthday.
And to just do some emails with us. So
you know, I was spinning past Instagram and caught on something here, and I started down a rabbit hole of thought, which is Simone your given first name?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So it's as if your parents knew what your career vocation was going to
be. Do you know what?
that's a perfect sex name.
Sex therapist.
Well, I was actually named, and this is where sort of the comparisons end, and this is where you're so smart. I was named after Simone de Beauvoir.
Yeah.
Oh,
there you
my
go.
And
gosh.
Then, without knowing
that's my
that,
favorite existential philosopher. You know what's weirder about that? Do you know what's weirder?
That I remind you of her so much with our existential
weirder, weirder, weirder. Oh, I was talking about her philosophy one day, and Bob goes, "Oh yeah, I knew her." He goes, yeah,
"I met her. One
I met. I took her around, had lunch with her." And I'm like, "What?
Oh,
you met Simone de Beauvoir?
Goodness, you are a legend."
Yeah. She made a movie called Blood of Others.
Oh my gosh!
How crazy is that?
Oh my gosh! You see, even my mom is going to be so impressed with that.
Yeah,
that's.
Did you know
wow.
she was at the time? Did
I kind of knew Sartre from college, and then
Sartre.
I knew that
you knew Sartre. You knew his girlfriend was Simone
yeah,
de Beauvoir,
and she was always
oh my
with
gosh.
Him.
Yeah,
but in the white privileged male world that we live in, I always thought that he was the important one. Her literature is actually more successful
okay.
and more
so,
world renowned
right.
so
than him.
Jean-Paul Sartre was sort of the
he was just a media figure.
Well, but he was the final stages of continental existentialism. And his girlfriend was Simone de Beauvoir, and she much more insightful.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Much more applicable, much more real, much more rich. And yeah. no one would listen to her stuff. And she subjugated herself to him.
Oh, did she?
She always
yeah, they had an
the
office.
Real.
I have a picture of them. They had an office
oh
with
this
two
crazy.
Tables.
This
two
crazy.
Two yeah. tables in it, and they would write side by side in the same room.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he got all the notoriety. So Sartre, Camus, these were all these French existentialists from the time. And he wrote a book called Being and Nothing. Wasn't that Sartre's big one, Being and Nothing? Being and Time was Heidegger, and then Being and Nothing was Sartre. And I don't like his philosophy at all.
And what is it that you don't like?
It doesn't ring true to me.
Right.
It's so abstract and it's so cold and it's so. He doesn't seem to have any understanding of psychology at all.
Right.
She has a deep understanding
yeah.
of human experience and human nature. And
you are named after
it.
Her.
I'm named after her, and it wasn't something that my mom and I discussed.
Why did she live in the shadow of a man for 50 years?
That's what
puzzles me.
I know. Les Français, we have to ask them. There's a cultural piece there, too.
Yeah.
Post-World War II, French. I don't know.
She had to know I'm way smarter than him the whole time.
I hope so. But women generally knew that about themselves, right?
But still, and anyone can absolutely tell me if this isn't the case, but certainly in Paris, we used to hear in England that it was still the very Parisian way. Parisian women would have babies, and literally 1 week after having a baby, they would look absolutely perfect because it was quite well known that their husbands, it really was, and I'll put okay in speech marks, it was okay for them to have extramarital affairs. Mm. It's kind of expected. So French women look absolutely, get their fine underwear, get their bodies back
what,
in shape
to try
straight
to hang
away
on to the husband, or?
To hang on to the husband. Oh, and so just going into your point, Bob, what you were saying about Simone de Beauvoir.
Yeah.
It's
living
it's,
in the shadow
it's
of
interesting,
him.
Isn't it?
It's a weird thing.
Let's go to some, let's see.
It is the perfect name for what you do.
Thank you. And no one has ever said that. And you are a genius.
Cool.
You're
here is
so
a,
perceptive.
Some email. I had brain surgery in my orbital frontal cortex and frontal lobe when I was 8. Since then, personality, severe anger, anxiety, depression changed drastically. 20 years later, I'm trying to get dialectical behavioral therapy, which would help him. Okay.
What
anger
was the
management.
Famous case of the guy who got the bar stuck
it's
through his head?
That's exactly right.
What
it's
is that case?
Phileas Cage.
Do you know about this guy?
No.
He was a miner.
No, he was a rooked on the railroad.
A railroad.
And he was
guy.
Tamping explosive down with right. a tamping rod, which are these giant metal rods, and the thing blew up and it went through his head.
But it didn't affect him in any way.
Well,
what?
No, hold on.
No, well, wait till you hear the story.
Yeah.
Okay, go on, Dr. Drew. It blew out his eye.
It blew out his eye. And it came out the top of his head. So he had a couple of difficult days, and then he recovered.
Oh, I love that. I'm so sorry. Difficult days!
Yeah. Imagine if that happened. Just imagine if that happened to a millennial Los Angelian. They would talk about it the rest of their existence.
No, I'm sorry, but I think that is okay, too. Yeah, you know, when you get stabbed through the eye, the razor,
and that
a
is
difficult day.
And it's exactly the region that our emailer has had damage, wow. The orbital frontal system, right?
Well, it gets worse, Simone.
Okay,
listen.
So he comes up from that, and he seems okay.
Everybody thinks it's a miracle, is what the report was.
They think he's okay, and he seems
all right.
He can talk. He seems fine. He's sort of himself, sort of, but he's a little more passive.
Uh-huh.
He has trouble returning back to work. He was an executive. He was a very hardworking. He was a railroad guy. He was laying down railroads. Couldn't seem to do that anymore. And then he gradually deteriorated to the point after about 10 or 15 years.
Of a madman.
Well, where he apparently was like a stagecoach. He could like a taxi driver
uh-huh.
who led down the road. And he couldn't control his language. He'd use expletives. He would reach sexually at people inappropriately. He was out of control with anger and dysregulated. Oh. So the orbital frontal system, we know, sits at the focus here of our lobes. And allows us to appreciate the content of others' minds, allows us to regulate our own affect. And all that exchange he didn't have anymore. And so he became a sociopath, essentially, like a sociopath, except a sociopath with disinhibited,
right,
who had no
right.
inhibitions. And it was not pretty.
And not very sophisticated, because sociopaths naturally kind of grow to become readers of people and take
right.
advantage. He had none of that. He was a nice guy,
yeah.
and then a piece of iron went through his brain,
oh,
and he was a sociopath.
Yeah, yeah.
And how many years ago was this?
This is 1850s, and it's a famous case. If you want to read about it, it's in a book called Descartes' Error by Damasio. Really good description of it.
Descartes' Error.
Controversy around the case and stuff, but it fits my understanding.
Well,
of biology.
One was his old friends reported this is not the same man.
Right.
Right? Just how he talked, how he thought. You know, it was as if it's the person that I grew up with or I worked with for 20 years, but this is not the same man, was the quote.
Right. And as we now know, traumatic brain injury changes our personalities and things. But this particular writer, Kyle, dialectical behavioral therapy is exactly the kind of thing that might help him, and he needs that. The poor guy should get it.
Now, at Christmas.
And some medication, too.
What's his name?
Kyle.
Kyle. Lovely Kyle. We hope you get better soon. At Christmas, we had a friend who basically fell down some stairs in Soho. He'd had a couple of drinks, Soho, London. He'd had a couple of drinks, but it really wasn't like he was, you know, completely trolleyed.
And trolleyed?
Trolleyed, meaning, I don't know where that comes
needs
from.
To go on the trolley and not
what does it mean?
Mean not very, very drunk.
Okay, trolleyed.
Oh, I think it British. Means not drive.
Occasionally.
Take the trolley home.
Oh my gosh, Bob, you're just like,
I've just been really drunk and I know all the terms for it. I've been called it in every culture. You should not drive in every culture.
And so he you know, had blood gushing from him. He seemed absolutely fine. And then the people at the bar said, no, just go to hospital. So he went to the socialized healthcare system in the UK. And they said, do you know what? You look okay, but just stay here overnight. Overnight in a coma. And for 3 days, didn't know whether he was going to live or die. Who he is, so he did survive, the loveliest guy. But the reason why I'm mentioning this is I was talking to my coach, who is into hypnotherapy and NLP, and we were talking about proper brain trauma, right? And he was talking about hypnosis, and so I recorded like this guided meditation for our friend Darren. But what he noticed, going back to Darren, what he noticed is he was absolutely fine, had to learn how to walk. But now suddenly,
personality changes. Yeah, very common. And especially if it happens early in life. Very, very common.
I think we have to wrap it up now.
Okay, let me just tell one quick story, which is regarding this young lady that's sitting next to us, named after Simone de Beauvoir. I looked into Western equine encephalitis, and seizures a common presentation. She had a generalized seizure, and then was encephalopathic for 4 days, and they didn't do any workup on her for encephalitis. I couldn't believe it.
When was this?
Oh, she didn't call us, which was her first mistake.
It was awful. Well, I wouldn't have remembered your name. Didn't know mine.
And they were going, well, it's just your seizure. It's like, no, seizure does not do that. Yeah. Does not do. She didn't have status. She had a sudden seizure and was encephalopathic.
And what caused the encephalopathy?
Encephalitis. From a mosquito virus, I guarantee you.
Yeah.
And then Simone, did you have mosquito bites? Oh, we were inundated with mosquitoes the week before.
It was the week before, and I remember looking it up, and I was talking with my clients about it, going, have you been bitten recently? And there was like this, like,
Where were you bitten? Here in L.A.?
In L.A.
Western equine encephalitis happens every summer. There's all kinds of stuff coming this summer. I'll tell you about it in the next podcast.
And there was a big outbreak in October.
In Burbank area.
Yeah.
Oh, because of the rains.
Because of the horses.
What?
Equine encephalitis. It's mosquitoes. It's because of the next.
How come people that work around horses don't get it all
the
time? They
do. Not all the time, because the mosquitoes take it out, vector it. Yeah.
I'm very tasty, which I think means smelly.
Yeah. All right, let's wrap it up. Thank you for helping out with some of these.
We'll leave it with that.
Sweaty.
Thank you for this, and Simone, come back soon for a pod, yes?
Thank you, right. I will.
And we'll see you next time.
Okay.
All right, that's about it for this episode of This Life. Thanks for listening and subscribing on your favorite platforms. Rate us 5 stars and tell a friend. Also, be sure to visit drdrew.com for the latest news. We'll tell you where you can find all of our health-related content, including the latest in-depth series, The History of Opium. You can now listen to it on the weekly Infusion podcast. We have some great and very interesting and appropriate interviews with key historical players in the history of opium. We're excited about our newest podcast, Dr. Drew After Dark, which has been described as a dark web reboot of Loveline. It's the hottest guest spot for all the most popular comedians. Beware, it is for a mature audience. It is kind of a reboot of Loveline. You can hear the episodes first in a podcast form Thursday. Then on Friday, you can watch all the video episodes when the YouTube page drops on the Your Mom's House YouTube channel. New episodes every week. Subscribe, tell a friend. Also on Dr.com, you can find Swole Patrol, our health and fitness podcast with Mike Catherwood. If you want something a bit more refined that will expand your intellectual horizons, please subscribe to the Dr. Drew podcast, where I feature a wide variety of very interesting and important guests. Get in-depth interviews there. Last but not least, me and Adam and Dr. Drew Show podcast. It's a lot of fun, and we are still together, and you can get it 5 days a week. So go to drdrew.com. Please tell a friend, and we thank you for it. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.